16 p.m. our most timely start in a month or two. Thursday, April 12th, 2018, Max Greenberg, Grimwald, the Secretary, please call the roll.
Representative Wolf?
Here.
Representative Levine? Representative Birch? Representative Johnson? Representative Tuck?
Here.
Representative Knapp?
Here.
Chair Price-Tompkins?
Here. And
Birch is here.
And Representative Birch just joined us with five members present. We have a quorum to conduct business. Three items on today's agenda. We punted a couple till next week. HB 409, second hearing relating to DMV indirect expenditures. A second hearing of HJR 30, Representative Josephson, and a second hearing on SB 196, appropriation limit from the Senate Finance Committee. On HB 409, there was an amendment deadline at 10 a.m. this morning. We have no amendments to consider. There is, however, public testimony noticed at this time. I will open. Is there anyone in the room to testify on HB 409? Seeing none, I will go online. I don't see anyone online to testify on HB 409, and we'll close public testimony. Committee's reference, Marla Thompson and Michael Stanker are both available online for questions. And are there any questions from the committee in the second hearing on HB 409? Representative Wold, do you want to follow up on the question that you posed last week? Or
I did. Correct. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mike, thank you for reminding me. My question was, what are the violations that currently one would need SR-22 insurance for life? I'm assuming it's a major infraction, because they said DUIs and stuff like that would not qualify.
Mr. Stinker, are you on answer Representative Wolf's question?
Yeah, for the record, Michael Stanker, Assistant Attorney General on behalf of DMV, through the chair, to answer Representative Wolf's question. So for SR-22 requirements, there's two instances where a person would need to have an SR-22 for life. One is under 28.20.330, which is subject to the HB 409 amendment, and that's the situation where if you fail to pay a judgment stemming from an auto accident, you get your license suspended. If you then subsequently satisfy the judgment, you have to have an SR-22 for life. The other instance pertains to DUIs. If you have four or more DUIs or refusal to submit to a chemical test, you would also have to have an SR-22 as long as you're licensed. Under DUIs, if it's your first DUI or refusal, you'd have a five-year period. For your second, a 10-year period, and for your third, 20-year period. And then other SR-22 requirements are for all other SR-2, excuse me, all other SR-22 requirements are for 3 years. So those are for if you had your license revoked or suspended for another reason and then you got it reinstated, you'd have to have it for 3 years. If it was suspended for points, for example, you'd have a 3-year period. Also, if you were involved in an auto accident and you didn't have insurance and your license was then suspended, that would then be, and then you got your license back, you'd be under a 3-year SR-22 requirement. So I think that addresses the representative's question.
Follow-up, Representative Wolf.
Thank you, and thank you, Mr. Stanker. You have it for life. The refusals, first, second, third, 5, 10, 20 years. What is the first DUI? Is that a similar to a first refusal?
Through the chair, Representative Wool, yes. So the first DUI or the first refusal is for a 5-year period.
Okay, thank you. So the refusal and the DUIs are parallel. And what was the first one you said? If you get in an accident, and I guess that's the one that's being addressed in this statute, but can you state that very first one again?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Wool. So what the statute's addressing is a situation where you get in an auto accident and you're sued, the plaintiff gets a judgment against you, you then don't pay that judgment within 30 days. The court then notifies DMV of the situation. DMV suspends your license. Your license is suspended until the judgment is paid or under one of the exceptions to that. For example, if you enter into a payment plan with your judgment creditor or they consent to you getting your license back. So after you get your license back, either through because it's paid or under one of the exceptions, then you have to have the SR-22 for life, and that's what the bill is seeking to amend.
Thank you, and through the chair, I guess. You're rewarded by SR-22 for life, so that's even worse than 3 DUI penalty, which seems very... And I guess that's why we're fixing it.
If I may, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Tuck.
I forgot who the presenter's name was. Stinker. Mr. Stinker, so did what Representative Wool repeated back, is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Tuck, yes. So if it's your third DUI or refusal conviction, you're looking at a 20-year SR-22 period, and if it's four or more, then it's lifetime, and then that's the same for failure to pay off a judgment. It's also lifetime, and that's it's failure to pay it off within 30 days. So if you pay it off within 60 days, it's still that lifetime SR-22 requirement.
And if I may just make a comment, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I hope we can fix that one because, you know, a 21-year-old kid gets in a car accident, down on his luck, can't pay, and he's got to spend the rest of his life on SR-22 insurance. I mean, that sounds like, it has nothing to do with his risk, has nothing to do with his ability to drive, has everything to do with within the first 30 days of being able to pay something. I don't understand why you want to strap somebody for life like that, whereas you have somebody repeatedly doing DWIs and doesn't have the same penalty. I hope we can fix that.
Yeah, and I think I'm of a similar mind. Representative Knopp.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If a judgment is filed against you, you have 30 days to pay. When are you eligible to have your license back in that particular scenario?
Through the chair, Representative Knopp, yes. So under the statute as written, if you don't pay within 30 days, your license is suspended until you either satisfy the judgment in whole or you fall into one of the exception categories, which is your judgment creditor consents to you getting your license back, or you get on a payment plan to get your license back.
Okay, thank you, sir. That answered my question. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, Representative Wool.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Stanker, so one of the incidences you explained was if you're in a car accident and you're uninsured, you lose your license for 3 months, and then after that you have to have SR-22. I think you said 3 years. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Wool, yes. If you get your license suspended for getting in an auto accident and not having insurance, I think it's an auto accident above, it's either personal injury or a dollar threshold amount. Then after your suspension period is up, then you're on SR-22 for 3 years.
And follow up,
Representative Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, the one incident, the type of the SR-22 for life that we've been talking about, we're talking about an insured driver. So a driver has insurance, gets in a car wreck, is assigned a judgment, or I don't know what you say exactly, but a judgment is found against them for monetary damage, either to property that's something that's not covered by the insurance, so let's say run over a bicycle or something, and they're assessed a judgment of, say, $2,000, they don't have the money to pay days, so they pay it off in 50 days, but then they have high-risk insurance, even though they had like the uninsured driver is not punished nearly as much as the insured driver who has a judgment against him. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Wool. So one of the exceptions to the mandatory lifetime SR-22 failure to pay a judgment is if your insurance company is liable for the payment. But I guess in a situation where if your insurance didn't cover some portion of the judgment for whatever reason, and you're liable for it, then yes, you'd be on the hook then for SR-22 for life. The issue with the 3 years for failure to have insurance is if you should have had insurance and you didn't, and then your license gets suspended, that's when the 3 year period kicks in. So they're related, but they are a bit different.
And Representative, I'm going to take a quick at ease because I'm going to have to pass off the gavel here for just a few minutes. Going at ease. Yes, Representative Ledoux is going to take over, and since I've been involved in HB 409, maybe set this aside for the time being. We'll roll back to it when I get back and hear public testimony in HJR 30. The resolution from Representative Josephson, which was noticed today, and go from there. So I'm going to pass the gavel to Representative.
Can that thing move?
Yes.
Okay.
The gavel has been moved. Representative Ledoux, thank you.
All right. So it looks like we are on public testimony with respect to our second item of business today, which is HJR 30, urging U.S. support of refugees. So I am going to open up public testimony right now. And it looks like we have one person on the line, Ms. Gabby Weiss. Ms. Weiss, would you like to identify yourself for the record and tell us if you're affiliated with anyone, and then you may proceed.
Hi, I'm Gabby, and I am 14. I'm from Carney Middle School.
Pardon me?
What?
Hello?
Hi. Okay, right now as I'm speaking, there are men, women, and children who are fleeing from war, persecution, and natural disaster right now. And it isn't just a few hundred thousand people, or even just a million people. According to the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, there are 22.5 million people fleeing for their safety. And guess how many of that number of refugees are children? Is it a tenth? A fifth? A third? No. More than one half of the 22.5 million people are children under the age of 18. They didn't choose to be born into an unsafe area. This is a huge number of people facing adversity and trauma, but even though you can't help everyone, you can still make a difference. This resolution will show that we Alaskans care about the other people who are in need of our love and support. Also, the U.S. can benefit from taking refugees in itself. In fact, the National Bureau of Economic Research explains an adult refugee will generally pay $21,000 more in taxes than they will receive in benefits in their first 20 years in the U.S. A thought stopping Americans from welcoming refugees is the idea that refugees may be terrorists. The acceptance process of refugees includes in-depth vetting, and according to the U.S. Department of State, it can take up to 24 months. In addition, as of 2015, the Kathleen Newman from the Migration Policy Institute said the U.S. has recorded 784,000 refugees since September 11, 2001. And in those 14 years, exactly 3 resettled refugees have been arrested for planning terrorist activities. And it is worth noting 2 are not planning an attack in the U.S., and the plans of the third were barely credible. because we are the lucky ones to get to have
Miss,
meetings.
Ms. Weiss, I'm going to have to start asking you to wrap it up, please.
Okay. Because we are the lucky ones who get to have meetings and eat lunch and read the newspaper and spend time with our friends and family, we need to take it upon ourselves to care and support the other humans who aren't as lucky as us. This is so important to me because if I were in that situation, I would want someone to help me. Please vote for House Joint Resolution Number 30. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much. Does anybody have any questions?
Yes.
Yes.
Could you
Is there an email that I should send it to?
Yes, there is.
There is. Just a second.
We'll recite that to you here in a sec. I have
Okay.
Awesome. I go to Colony Middle School.
Awesome.
Homer Lasker.
Great. Well, that's very.
And the email address to send it to is hsta@akledge.gov.
Did you get that?
Yes.
All right. Well, thank you very much. It's always nice to have students who are involved with the legislative process. Representative Johnson.
Well, hi there. I just wanted to tell you that I really appreciated you calling in, and I know that you've this is one of your passions, and thank you so much for all the work that you've done to, and all the consideration that you've put into this bill, and we really appreciate your public testimony.
Any other questions? All right. Well, thank you very much. And it looks like Ms. Weiss was the only one who is listed to publicly testify here from outside the building. Is there anybody in the audience who wishes to testify on HJR 30? Okay, then we are going to close the testimony on HJR 30, and we are going to set that bill aside for now. The third item of business on this agenda is SB 196 appropriation limit. And again, we're going to have public testimony on that. And it doesn't look like there is anybody online for public testimony. Is there anybody in the audience? So we're going to open up public testimony. And it looks like there's no one online for public testimony on SB 196. And so we will, is there anybody in the audience? So we will close public testimony on that bill, and we will hold that bill. And then the looks like the next item on the agenda is presentation on penalties for marijuana possession. And I guess I'm not sure. It looks like we've got one person online, Tracy Dompeling, the director of the Division of Juvenile Justice. Is there anybody in the audience also? No. At ease for a moment. Okay. So we've got, a presentation on penalties for marijuana possession. The presenters are Ashley Strout, Staff Representative Wall, and Kathy Schling, Ida, Staff to Representative JKT. And we also have online to answer questions, Tracy Dompeling, the director of the Division of Juvenile Justice. Do you want to begin your presentation, Ms. Strout?
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, for the record, my name is Ashley Strout, staff to Representative Wohl, And this presentation today is in response to a piece of draft legislation that was being considered for this committee that, for a variety of reasons, time being the major factor, has turned into a presentation for you today. But this presentation concerns possession of marijuana on school grounds. The current law mandates that possession of marijuana on school grounds, school buses, and in or near youth centers is grounds for a felony charge. And this legislation would change charges related to marijuana possession to a Class A misdemeanor or Class B misdemeanor. We can get into the details on that if you'd like. But Class A misdemeanors would be charged for possession of more than 1 ounce of marijuana, while Class B misdemeanors would be charged for possession of 1 ounce or less. There are no differences in charges based on age as a part of this considered idea here today, and further information will be provided as questions come up. And at this point, Kathy has a draft presentation for us to go through.
For the record, this is Kathy Schoenheit, staff to Representative Chris Tompkins. Through the chair, I've distributed to the committee a draft of legislation. The committee will not be introducing it this session. It's just a work draft to consider on possible ways to modify this legislation, as Ashley was discussing. Section 1 removes the removes the section that makes it a Class C felony to possess any amount of marijuana within 500 feet of school grounds, on school buses, or within 500 feet of youth centers. So even an otherwise legal amount possessed by an adult would be a Class C felony in any of these circumstances. So Section 1 would remove that. Section 2 would make it a Class A misdemeanor to have more than 1 ounce, which is in line with penalties outside of these restricted areas. So having more than 1 ounce generally on the street would be a Class A misdemeanor, and this would make that true across the board. Section 3 would make it a Class B misdemeanor to have up to 1 ounce within 500 feet of a school or on a school bus. It's already a Class B misdemeanor for a minor to possess up to 1 ounce, which is an amount that's legal for an adult. It's a Class B misdemeanor anywhere for a minor. This would make it the same true for minors across the board, but for adults, having a legal amount within one of these restricted areas would become a Class B misdemeanor. Section 4 establishes an affirmative defense. Being in a private residence within 500 feet of a school means that you, as an adult, are allowed to possess an otherwise legal amount of marijuana. Section 5 is just statutory cleanup to align with other sections of the bill. Section 6 makes sure that the changes do not apply retroactively, so they would not affect pending cases, even if the case was decided after the effective date of the act. We're available to take questions if anyone's interested.
Any questions for either Ms. Strauch or Ms. Schlenkheide? Representative Knott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm trying to understand. It went pretty quick for me because I'm a slow listener. But so the intent of the original felony was to keep people from, I'll say, dealing at schools. That was the intent of the original felony charge. Now you're wanting to move it to misdemeanors, is that correct? Class A and B misdemeanors?
Through the chair, Representative Knopf, that's correct. It would be a Class A misdemeanor for more than an ounce, a Class B misdemeanor for up to an ounce.
But then I heard you talk about Class C felonies still in existence. So I guess my question really is, if this thing is introduced and adopted, are we removing severe penalties for those who try to deal in a school area? And that's, so you guys are, so the bill goes to lean in a little leniency to students who should go to school with it. And I agree with that, but I don't agree with reducing it for people who are there trying to, so does this bill address both the issues?
Through the chair, Representative Knopf, you're correct. For minors, the concern is a student has a small amount for recreational use, and there are concerns about them having a felony conviction for that, which will follow them potentially. Particularly for seniors who have turned 18, they can be tried as an adult, then they have an adult felony conviction, which can be very serious. It would make it a misdemeanor still for an adult to have a Class B misdemeanor to have an otherwise legal amount. It is within 500 feet of a school grounds, which is a pretty significant distance. There's certainly room to consider returning to a Class C felony for an adult, say, within school grounds, if you wanted to create perhaps a more narrow exception.
And Madam Chair, so I guess if we move forward with this at some point in the future, I would definitely want to see maybe under 18 recreational amounts being misdemeanors, but when you get above that age of consent, 18 or up, and you're carrying more than what's allowed recreationally, then I think the stiffer penalties need to stay in place. So just consider that if you're moving forward with legislation, or if you want my support for it anyway. Okay, so thanks.
You might also want to consider that there might be a difference between an adult on the school ground who is not attending the school and an adult on the school ground who is simply a senior who has reached the age of 18 years old. There might be a rational distinction along those lines also. Representative Wong?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So Representative Knopp brought up the concept of dealing, which I don't know if it's addressed elsewhere in statute, what that quantity would be. But this says an ounce or more, which is the barrier between, for an adult currently off school grounds, under an ounce is legal, over an ounce is a misdemeanor. So if someone had an ounce and a half on their person, is that a dealing amount, or is that just slightly over the legal amount, or does the law make a distinction? In other words, if a individual is on school grounds, say, picking up their kid after school and happens to have slightly over the legal amount in their vehicle, this current law is a felony. Well, any amount's a felony. Is there a distinction between dealing and non-dealing, I guess?
Through the chair to Representative Wohl, there is not in statute a definitive amount that constitutes a dealing amount versus a possession amount. However, in public, outside of school grounds, over an ounce and anything much greater than over an ounce tends to raise eyebrows and lead to further investigation about what activities might be going on. And I would also say that this draft legislation would put the penalties for adults on school grounds in line with the penalties that exist in public, with the exception that currently, if you have under an ounce as an adult off of school property, that's a legal amount that you can carry, and on school grounds it would still be illegal to carry any amount of marijuana on school grounds.
Also, through the chair, Representative Wohl, we have had conversations with prosecutors about the situation, and there are other crimes that people can be charged with if they're dealing beyond simple possession. And in our conversations, they've said that it's always very clear to them when an amount is for personal use and whether it's for dealing, not based on ounces, but just based on testimony from witnesses. And it's very obvious. People know if someone in a school is dealing, and then they pursue additional charges that compound on each other.
Follow up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I guess that was sort of where I was going. The intent to distribute usually can be indicated by other things, say, someone holding 20 small packages and, of course, scales and all that other stuff. So if someone just happened to have a slightly over the legal amount, that's different than someone who the law enforcement could indicate had intent to distribute. And I guess that's what you were just saying.
Through the chair, Representative Wohl, that's correct.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm trying to figure out how to exactly state my question. I know when I, so I'll start with my statement here. When I was as mayor, I was mayor when marijuana became illegal, legal. One of their concerns, the police officer's concerns, that you can smell marijuana, there's a lot more, it's a lot easier to kind of spot marijuana, but usually if people are dealing drugs, they'll hide the harder drugs. They can, there's no real smell, odor, or whatever, but it's easier. And particularly, a lot of the police dogs are trained to sniff out marijuana, because they're usually people that have large quantities of other drugs will also have marijuana. So I guess what I'm trying to figure out is what's the bill trying to fix? And because some of it I can see, like if your home just happens to be within a small, short distance of school, obviously that kind of makes sense. But some reason that we're feeling that we have to make sure that the soccer moms that happen to have something in their car, you know, that we're accidentally picking them up, maybe there is a reason to have some of this in statute, just as a way of being able to give a tool to our law enforcement officers. So I mostly wanted to see what you feel this bill will fix, or what issues that are out there that this is addressing.
Through the chair to Representative Johnson, this bill fixes a few different concerns. One is that a youth would have a felony on their record for any amount of marijuana possession, which some might consider a harsh penalty for someone under 18. Another thing that it fixes is, or attempts to fix, is the situation where a parent or other adult comes near a school ground or comes to pick up their student after school, possibly, and has under an ounce or even over an ounce of marijuana in their car, on their person, and reduces that from a felony, so that they don't have as strong of penalties for their recreational products. And another thing that this bill fixes is that I would in particular see as important is it removes youth center from this definition of school grounds. Youth centers in statute is defined very broadly as any public or private entity that caters to any youth under the age of 18. My example for this is that I actually went to a daycare as a child in a residential neighborhood. It didn't have proper signage outside. There was no indication that this was a daycare facility, but in statute that would qualify as a youth center. So by removing that from this definition, we're also trying to prevent folks from participating in activities that otherwise would be completely legal or acceptable. We're trying to prevent those folks from having a felony on their record.
This is Kathy, for the record, through the chair, Representative Johnson. To address your other point about being able to smell marijuana or police being able to find it more easily, this bill, as written, would still make sure that it was a misdemeanor, so it would still be a crime on school grounds, which means that it would be justifiable cause for law enforcement to search, so they wouldn't lose that ability.
Representative Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you have a number for how many situations or how many times somebody has been charged with a Class C felony for, you know, being within 500 feet of a school or on a school bus or within 500 feet of a youth center? I mean, is this happening frequently? Has it never happened at all? Or what's I assume that there's been some assessment of that through the chair.
Through the chair, Representative Birch. We have been speaking with prosecutors and with the court system about this, and it's a little bit difficult to track unexpectedly because a lot of these cases are being pled down. So people are being charged with a Class C felony, and then it's pleading down to a misdemeanor. And so we're still working on getting numbers, but there's not a firm number of cases. Also, some of these are sealed juvenile records, so it's a lot harder to track the number of cases that are in play.
Follow up.
That's the reasonableness approach. I like reasonable, and it strikes me that if they're pleading it down, that's reasonable. And so I guess, you know, in you know, I mean, if somebody's panicking about not getting this out the door tomorrow, it strikes me that the prosecutors are recognizing that, you know, we don't feel like slapping some kid around that's, you know, and, but hopefully they've still got the flexibility to get the bad guys that are, you know, lurking around looking, you know, selling drugs in a place where they have no business being. But anyway, I was just kind of curious as to how big a number that was or how frequently that happened. And kind of in a selfish way, I've got grandkids in grade school, and so I'm kind of interested in, you know, hopefully that's not going on, but it's always nice to know. Thank you.
And Representative Knopp got you in the queue. I was going to say, might just ask if Tracy Dompelling, the Director of Divisional Juvenile Justice, might have any comment on that question as well. Ms. Dompelling, on the record, and could you comment on Representative Birch's question?
Yes, for the record, this is Tracy Dompling, and I'm the Director for the Division of Juvenile Justice. Through the Chair, Representative Birch, I am looking at statistics that we have from the Division of Juvenile Justice from FY13 to current in FY18. Over those years, we've had referrals, which is the equivalent of a police report coming into the division, for about 909 instances of possession of marijuana on school grounds. So far this year in FY18, we have seen about 101 referrals come in.
Follow up. Thank you for that. That does put some context on this proposal. Have any of them been prosecuted as felonies, or are these largely students? You know, I mean, are these students, or are they you know, people, are they all juveniles for the most part? Through the chair.
Mr. Chair, those, in the majority of those instances, they're actually adjusted. The Division of Juvenile Justice actually has the statutory authority to not have to prosecute all of the cases. So there are other mechanisms that probation officers may use to hold that youth accountable for being in possession of marijuana on school grounds. That being said, there is a small number of juveniles who were taken to court for that particular offense of marijuana on school grounds. However, it's important to note that it is a rare instance that we would take those cases to court for that felony. Many times when the felony is charged against the youth, for example, it's happening in conjunction with other types of offenses that are coming in on that referral. So, for instance, if a youth happens to get into a fight at school with someone or assault someone, say after stealing an iPod, and then during that investigation is also found to be in possession of marijuana, there may be a petition that's actually for three charges, not just standalone for that possession of marijuana on school grounds.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Knopp.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sir, felonies and right to court. So are you really seeing a need for this legislation to change then, because you have that flexibility today?
Through the chair, Representative Knopp, we, regardless of whether this charge is a felony or a misdemeanor offense, it's not going to change the way that the division responds to allegations of this type of delinquency. Our system is not one based on, you know, a punitive system of specific amount of time served or anything like that. It's based off of identifying, you know, looking at the youth's likelihood of risk to reoffend, as well as what needs does that youth have to hopefully prevent them from committing crimes in the future.
Okay, thank you for that. And then for your staff members, I just through the chair, I got to say that I find it really intriguing that your generation is presenting this issue to our generation. I find it real interesting. And I'm really happy that you're doing so, because times have changed, as you guys all recognize, in the last couple of years. So nothing I would hate to see worse than to see students charged with felonies following them around for the rest of their life. So I'm glad you brought this forward. I hope you are encouraged to pursue it for next year, and you got some time to work on it. I think it's probably something that should be talked about. And we brought up a lot of things today about not letting those who are on school grounds for different reasons get away with the misdemeanors and other considerations. So anyway, I applaud you for your efforts. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Knopp. And just a quick comment. I think this is the intent. This issue was flagged and thought it might be worth looking into a little bit more. Probably not going to do anything this session, obviously, but next year, who knows. Representative Ledoux.
So under the initiative, marijuana is supposed to be treated like alcohol. So I was just sort of wondering, what are the penalties for alcohol on a school ground or selling alcohol on the school ground? Do you know? Does anybody know?
Through the chair to Representative Ledoux, I might direct that question to Tracy.
Okay.
Director Dompelling, do you happen to know what the penalties for having alcohol on school grounds are?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, unfortunately I do not, because the minor consuming alcohol charges refer to the Division of Juvenile Justice. So I don't have that information, unfortunately.
Representative Wool might know the answer to this question.
For no particular reason, I know we changed the law, I believe it was HB 199 from 2 years ago. It was a section of the Title IV rewrite at the time that they wanted to reduce the underage drinking so that not everyone got a misdemeanor at a party, but they got a violation, so it was like a ticket. And I don't know if that's differentiated on school grounds or not on school grounds, but I know if kids are at a party and there's drinking, they don't all get misdemeanors, and that was one of the purposes. I believe it was HB 199. So I don't think marijuana is treated like alcohol, and I think that's largely because marijuana is federally still a controlled substance, illegal.
Well, I would actually be interested in knowing how it's treated on school grounds.
And
we have a lifeline audience also from the Division of Juvenile Justice. Incognito.
Yeah, well. Mr. Chairman, my name is Matt Davidson. I'm a Social Services Program Officer with the Division of Juvenile Justice. Representative Rule, you're correct. 2 years ago, SB 165 changed the penalties for underage drinking, minor, and consuming alcohol, and that's a $500 fine and a district court appearance with an option to go through the ASAP alcohol program or a youth court to address the underage drinking. The division does not see alcohol-related offenses, and I don't remember if there's any other questions that were part of that. But
on school grounds.
Oh, on school grounds. Yeah, there actually is a statute, and it's actually a bill that's currently under consideration. The alcohol rewrite actually touches. There is a separate crime, a misdemeanor related to a consumption of alcohol on school grounds. It's a misdemeanor for adults and juveniles to consume alcohol on school grounds or at school events, and the bill would. That's currently under consideration in both bodies does change that into a violation. I can say that we looked at our records related to alcohol consumption on school grounds, and we have no referrals. So that any underage drinking on school grounds gets a minor possession, not a misdemeanor under the crime statute.
So follow-up? Follow-up. No, it's... You were talking, so.
I think you have it, Representative Ledoux, your question originally.
Okay, so what about selling alcohol on school grounds?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I'm not aware of that particular crime. That would be in Title IV.
Thank you.
Representative Wall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Ledoux, I believe furnishing alcohol to a minor, I don't know, school grounds or not school grounds, is currently a misdemeanor. So, someone over 21, and someone under 21 providing alcohol to a minor, I don't know. Go ahead.
Through the chair, Representative, well, that's correct. Yeah, furnishing alcohol to a minor is currently a misdemeanor, and actually that's also addressed by the legislation that's under consideration in both bodies. And we do see minors under 18 occasionally refer to the division for the misdemeanor offense of furnishing, so we do have a handful of those. And we do see there's also a felony furnishing if there's some harm done, injury to the minor who's been furnished alcohol. And so we do see some referrals for minors providing alcohol to other minors, and there's an injury that occurs and they get a felony referral to the division. So the division currently sees those alcohol referrals for furnishing to minors.
And just to summarize, to confirm my understanding, the answer to Representative Ledoux's question, it sounds like there's not a complete apples to apples comparison, but it's right now it's a C felony to possess marijuana on school grounds, and it's effectively a misdemeanor, possibly going to become a violation depending on whether the Title IV rewrite passes or not, if you have alcohol on school premises. Am I getting the gist of it?
Mr. Chairman, for minors, for underage drinkers and consumption of alcohol, we do not see, the division does not see the misdemeanor charge. It's not one of the commonly charged crimes. I don't think adults actually, in discussions with the Department of Law, they don't see the crime of drinking alcohol at school being charged as a misdemeanor. I think adults, they generally tell them to pour it out or leave the premises, and the juveniles get a minor possession. The initiative was brought up. The initiative did not change any of the criminal penalties for anyone under 21 years old. So we have not seen a change. And I know Representative Ledoux was part of a lot of committee discussions around a bill a couple years ago. SB 30 was one of them. I don't remember the House number that looked at changing criminal penalties. But the criminal penalties for less than 21-year-olds possessing, consuming, using marijuana have not changed under the initiative. So it's still the criminal penalties, the misdemeanors, and felony-level crimes such as possession at school are intact.
Thank you very much. Representative Wall.
I don't even know. Representative Knopp made an interesting comment when he reflected on the generational divide, and I don't know exactly where he was going with that, but I know when I was in high school, if someone got in a fight and maybe there was a stolen item, maybe not, or maybe there was a small amount of marijuana possessed, misdemeanors and felonies were not brought up. You know, that they dealt with it on a disciplinary basis in the school. The police generally weren't brought in to charge. And I guess now, if a student has any amount of marijuana on him at a school, technically he could be charged with a felony. And our other person online said, if it happens, it's usually as a plea bargain device and not actually being convicted of a felony, typically. Have any adults been charged with a felony for marijuana on school grounds, just sort of incidental possession? And maybe we don't have that person in the room.
That might be Departmental Law or DPS. We can try to get that answer, Representative Wall. Any other questions from the committee? Thank you very much, Mr. Davidson, pinch hitting, Ms. Schlinghide, Ms. Straub, and Director Dompelling. And at this time, I think we'll circle back to HB 409, which we cycled off of at the beginning. I think where we left things, we were digging into Section 11. Representative Wohl or Representative Tuck, any question to sort of resume things or... Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, Mr. Chair. I personally see that it's amended for 10 years, which is taken away from lifetime SR 22. But I personally think 10 years seems a bit severe for someone to pay their liability within 30 days, where a DUI first time is 5 years, and I feel like not paying within 30 days is a less severe event than a DUI, someone who gets in a car accident with insurance but doesn't pay the damages within 30 days. And that just seems over onerous.
Representative Ledoux.
Well, I agree that it sounds overly onerous, but if he has insurance, there's not going to be anything for him to pay. Liability insurance doesn't have deductibles on it.
Representative Chair, I don't know what circumstance would cause someone to be assessed a judgment, maybe, but the insurance not cover it. and the Mr. Stanker was on the phone saying that this person could have insurance, get into a car accident and be assessed a judgment and not pay it within 30 days, they'd have SR-22 for life. And I think I'm getting that right.
And I could ask Mr. Stanker if there's anything about what you just said that was wrong, if that would be helpful. Mr. Stanker, if you're still with us and it looks as though you are, could you confirm what Representative Wohl just said is right or wrong?
Yeah, for the record, Michael Stanker, through the chair. If I understand the question, it's if you do have insurance, but your insurance doesn't cover some portion of a civil judgment that gets entered against you, you could then fall into this category with your license suspension and the lifetime SR-22. I think that's correct. I'm not familiar with all the ins and outs of automobile insurance and what they may or may not cover, or to the extent there are or not deductibles. But the way the law is written, though, is that if you get in an auto accident, you get sued, and the other side is successful, and you are then personally liable for the judgment or some portion of it, you pay within 30 days, and as the law is currently written, your license is suspended until you pay, and then after you pay, you have that lifetime SR-22 requirement.
Representative Ledoux.
I'd actually like to ask somebody from the Division of Insurance, because I've done a lot of insurance law, and my understanding is that, that there are deductibles if, for example, you own the car and the car gets wrecked and you're looking for your own insurance to pay for it. But your actual liability insurance, I don't think your liability insurance has deductibles. I mean, there could always be that the insurance company goes belly up or something. But I really don't think that liability insurance has deductibles.
Representative Tuck?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And liability insurance may not have deductibles, but they probably have caps. And they probably have caps in regards to injuries as well. And so I think the rest of the responsibility may fall on the one that caused the accident. Aside from that, I do have a problem. I said 21-year-old, but it could be an 18-year-old, it could be a 16-year-old that gets in an accident, and a 40-year-old. But I'm just looking at the lifetime of SR-22 for not being able to pay something in 30 days. That just really, really, whether it's the person had insurance or didn't have insurance, that just seems really extreme to me. Especially since it's a financial obligation, it's not because the person's a terrible driver necessarily. When you look at that, I mean, who's the penalty go to? It definitely goes to the insurance industry. I don't know, it's kind of like a debtor's prison in a way. You're bound for life, never able to get out of underneath that. Whereas someone who is drinking and driving gets all these extra chances, and they're definitely putting the public at risk. They're definitely not capable of driving. It definitely has something to do with their skills. And so a millionaire guy likes to have a few martinis. He gets off with a young kid who can't afford it. Doesn't? It just does not make logical sense to me.
I just want to jump in with Ms. Thompson and say, I mean, I have to, what Representative Wohl and Representative Tucker said resonates with me. And is there any reason this does make logical sense? And I guess I direct that to Ms. Thompson, if you have any arguments in favor of this arrangement.
Hi, this is Marla Thompson, for the record, with the DMV. And in response to that, the reason that we have, that somebody would have a judgment against them, have the unsatisfied judgment is because what, most of the time they don't have insurance when they get in that accident. So then they are sued by the other party, they lose that, and then they get a judgment. At that point, we suspend their license, and then for 3 years. Now, at that point, they will make, most of them make a payment plan. If they make the payment plan, then we will give them their license back. At the point that they miss payment,
chance.
I am. It is only a speaker phone too. Am I? Are you getting a echo?
That is the best audio quality. I mean, I'm able to hear what you're saying, and I think it's, unless you have the, do you have the?
Yes.
Could you do that? Mr. Stanker in the interim?
Yep, I'll be right with you.
Okay, thank you. Representative Ledoux.
So, do I understand correctly that, let's say you have a $100,000, your minimum policy, a $50,000 or $100,000 policy, and you end up with a judgment for $150,000. If you haven't paid, you end up having to pay this SR-22 or whatever it's called. Is that correct?
Mr. Stanker?
Yeah, for the record, Michael Stanker, through the chair, Representative Ledoux. I can't comment on the insurance aspect to your question. I'm just not familiar with insurance policies or insurance laws. But as written, though, if for whatever reason you somehow were on the hook for some portion of a judgment that your insurance company wasn't going to pay, then you would fall into this situation where your license would be suspended, and then if you paid, you paid off whatever you owed, you would have the lifetime SR-22 requirement.
Okay, so just a follow-up question here. When you have SR-22 insurance, I think SR-22 insurance usually has a limit on it, or maybe a cap. How much in SR-22 insurance do you need to have?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I'm not familiar with that. Ms. Thompson may be more familiar, or that may be a question for the Division of Insurance.
And I'm looking in the back of the room. Is Ms. Thompson back with us? Not yet. Okay.
I guess what I'm thinking about is if you had insurance for like $100,000 and you ended up with a judgment of $150,000, and you didn't pay that extra $50,000 right away, then you're required forever to pay SR-22 insurance. But I don't think SR-22 insurance has a limit too, and I think it's the minimum amount of insurance that you've got. So this makes like absolutely no sense whatsoever.
Good, Representative Wall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My understanding of SR-22 is it's special risk, so the person's deemed riskier and they have to pay a lot more, and I don't think the policy's any better. And I guess I have a question for Mr. Stanker, which is, so if someone does not have insurance, they get in a car accident, they lose their license for 3 months, then they get their license back, they buy SR-22 for 3 years. If they don't have insurance, same thing happens. They have a judgment. They don't pay the judgment within 30 days. They lose their life. They have SR-22 for life. So the same basic incident, one with a damage and one without a damage. One's 3 years, one's life of SR-22. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Wool, yes, that is correct. And if I could add, about this particular law, it was initially enacted in 1959, and it hasn't been amended since then. I don't know if that's useful information for the committee to consider or not, but that might provide background.
It seems notable, although I don't know what to make of it. Representative Wall.
Well, I didn't know we had SR-22 in 1959. I'm just trying to get my head around the difference of penalty for almost the same infraction. And then the other situation is if you have, I mean, this lifetime of SR-22 makes no distinction of insurance or not insured, whereas the other one says if you're not insured, it's automatic 3 years of SR-22. The other one is because you've incurred damages. And I guess if you're trying to pay back your damages and your insurance doubles in fee, then you're less likely to pay off your damages. But I don't know. It seems a little out of whack. Yeah, thanks.
Representative, I believe Marla Thompson is back online. Do you have a question?
Okay, yes, actually. So I'm trying to follow this. So you've got, what is the minimum amount of insurance that you need?
The minimum amount of insurance is the 20, gosh, I should know this. We're pulling it up in the book. We'll pull that up. But you just have to have liability insurance.
But there, you know, there's liability insurance for 50, there's liability for 100, there's liability for 1,000,000. What's the minimum that the state requires you to have?
I'm pulling the book out right now. I think it's 25, 50, 100, but I could be wrong.
Right. In personal.
Michael, do you have that number in front of you?
Mr. Stanker?
For the record, Michael Stanker, no, I'm not familiar with the insurance requirements.
We'll pull that up real quick. Let me just get on here. It's right here in the book. I happen to have a book on my desk.
So there is a minimum amount of insurance, and it's actually relatively low, correct?
Yes, it is.
Okay. So if somebody has that minimum amount of insurance, let's just say hypothetically it's $50,000 of liability insurance, and you end up with a judgment of $100,000, so then you owe another $50,000. So then you're required to have SR-22 insurance. But your SR-22 insurance isn't above the minimum either, is it?
No, it's just it's like a financial responsibility.
For how much?
It depends by carrier. So it's not even an amount. It's a high risk, is basically what you're saying, is you're high risk. And so there's only certain carriers that carry and provide high risk.
Okay, so, but you have to have this high risk insurance. How much, though? How much insurance do you have to carry? I mean, I know it's for high risk people. How much insurance does the state require that you have when you get the SR-22 insurance? It's the same amount.
The amount changes.
It's the same amount, but it's just more expensive, correct?
Correct.
So, how is it logical to make somebody this SR-22 high-risk insurance when they've already carried regular insurance and they carried the minimum of $50,000, but they ended up with a $100,000 judgment, and they weren't able to pay for that right away. So you're going to then make them pay the high-risk insurance, which is just in the same amount as the insurance to begin with. Tell me how that makes sense. Am I missing something?
No, I don't think you're missing anything on that. I don't know if it makes sense. It's just that's the way it's written. The customers that we're talking about, that we're dealing with on the financial responsibility, mostly don't have insurance. So that's why they get a judgment against them, because they don't have insurance. The other person's uninsured insurance has to pick it up, and then they sue them, and then they get the judgment. And then at the point that they're actually going to be required, they would be required for 3 years to have the SR-22. Then if they
don't make a payment on this final judgment, when they defaulted on that final judgment is the only time that they're required to have the lifetime SR-22.
Right. I guess what I'm concerned about is that it actually picks up people who have insurance, but maybe they're just carrying the minimum amount of insurance.
I think we could pull some data on to see what kind of customers that we're talking about.
Well, actually, even if you pull some data and find that there are very few of those people, if the statute's written like that, then somebody's going to, you know, end up affected by it, or conceivably could. I mean, I don't think the statute makes any sense as written.
I would agree with you on that.
Thank you.
All right, it sounds like we've uncovered some stinkers of statutes. Fascinating. Well, I wonder at this point whether it makes sense to drill down into this SR-22 stuff that seems no one thinks makes any sense as it's presently written since 1959 or whenever. Do a little bit of work and potentially come back to this. But I'd be interested in what the committee thinks.
If I may, Mr. Chair, I'd be more than happy to work with your office to try to come up with something. I think it's something that, along with the other fixes that we can have here, it can make it better for the public.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, I just want to, while I still have the thought, I think it would be interesting to know the data, even though I agree with what Representative Ledoux's comment, because I'd be interested to know if there are people who, you know, 16, 18, 20, whatever, they default on a judgment because their insurance didn't cover the full liability, and then they've had this lifetime obligation. And, I wanted to note that for Ms. Thompson. That would be helpful to learn a little bit more. Representative Wool.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, it sounds like I dodged a bullet, because when I was about 22 or so, I had a fender bender in my brother's car that was uninsured. I lost my license for 90 days. I had to buy SR-22 for 3 years. There was damage. I was able to fix it. My brother didn't take me to court, neither did the other party. But apparently, if they had and I didn't pay within 30 days, I'd be still buying SR-22 40 years later, which I don't think would be deserved, since I haven't had an accident since then. But, SR-22 is fine for a short period of time, but, I mean, I think this statute's way out of whack.
Hey, may I ask a couple questions?
Yeah, and I should also note Anna Latham from Division of Insurance has joined us as well. Representative Tuck.
Okay, if I may, a couple questions. First thing is, I'd like to have an SR-22 chart, if possible, to see these conditions laid out side by side. And another thing is would an insurance company be breaking the law if, after 20 years of someone being on SR-22 insurance for not meeting the 60-day requirement, decide to forgive the person and just charge them regular rates, they find them no longer at risk?
Ms. Latham, I know you're jumping into this cold, but did you, I think that last question might be best for you. Did you understand the question or the context of the question?
Mr. Chairman, this is Anna Latham from the Division of Insurance. I did just jump on this call. However, this bill, as it's currently written, doesn't really impact Title 21 at all. It's all under Title 28. I did hear your question, though, and I can respond to the committee in writing in the end of the day or perhaps tomorrow on that and follow up.
And Ms. Latham, just a little bit of context. We had a few questions about the insurance requirements for drivers, effectively, and neither Ms. Thompson or Mr. Stanker had the information offhand. Who is the expert on some of those questions, or does the Division of Insurance have expertise as far as this goes?
Mr. Chairman, those requirements regarding the SR 22 are all set by DMV. They're all under Title 28. However, if the committee does have, you know, further questions, we're happy to do everything we can to work with DMV and get responses to the committee members.
Okay, I think we got that.
I'll get that answered later.
Okay, sure. Sounds good, Representative Tuck. Further questions? Okay, Representative Tuck, we can tag team on this, and Representative Wolf, you're interested as well. Seems like everybody, maybe excepting Representative Birch, wants to get on this train.
I don't want to get in the middle of this. Your comments, Representative Wolf, resonate with me. I think that, I've actually worked in rural Alaska, and there's some communities where parents don't take the level of engagement in their kids that they would in other settings, and those kids get tagged with stuff as a kid that they shouldn't have to pack with them for the rest of their life, and I think that, I think this warrants a little more.
We'll do the work. let's see here. So we'll set this aside. 409 has been noticed in finance, and so we'll try to hustle here because we want to get it to them and get it to the Senate, and the Senate finance co-chairs are kind of plugged into a lot of this indirect expenditure work. So just given the, I think, goal of trying to make progress this session, I'm probably going to recess to the call of the chair. We can reconvene tomorrow briefly if we're able to make progress in that window. We'll do whatever we need to do. But I wanted to flag that for the committee. As a last, there was an amendment in the operating budget, as some of you might recall, relating to DEC and dairy fees, or the, I'm not sure if this rings a bell, Representative Pruitt sponsored it, and I've been working with Representative Pruitt since then. It gives DEC the ability to, similar to the Fire Life Safety Division assessing fees for their services, gives DC the ability to promulgate fees for dairies. And anyway, earlier that amendment, I've been with Representative the committee bill for us to consider and discuss that bill. Representative Wool, would you be willing to make the motion?
I will. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that an act relating to fees levied by resource agencies for designated regulatory services be introduced as a House State Affairs Committee bill.
Thank you, Representative Wool. Seeing and hearing no objection, so moved.
When do we get a chance to see it?
We'll get a work order back and share it with the committee as soon as we do, Representative Birch, and we'll just be considering it as a committee. It's not moving from committee, so we'll have due process on it. And I think at this time we'll recess to the call of the chair given this SR22 stuff on HB 409. So thank you very much for the good questions, and we'll be back at time uncertain. We're recessed.